Greetings and salutations, everyone. This is ACTGS. My name is Roy, and I am the net control operator for this, the Limar Technical Net. The Limar Technical Net runs at 8 o'clock every Sunday night and has for 39-plus years, most under the direct guidance of Dick, K2RIW, who unfortunately became Silas Key a year and a half ago. But we can bond the Technical Net in his memory, and hopefully to inform and entertain an audience of our fellow hams, and we get to share information from each other, and we all learn in the end. So that's the exercise that we're trying to do. Let me drop for a second, and I will give you my usual link to mine. Okay, as always, if you can't reach me via radio, there's always email. So if you want to ask a question, in the old days they would call that the mailbag section, where someone would read the email to Dick and say who does it. Or if you'd like to either discuss a topic or hear a topic discussed, you could ask or volunteer. Or if you have any puzzles, I'm always looking for interesting puzzles to pique up interest and give people a kind of refresher course on things that they sort of took for granted. Or if you would like to have me tap Paul on the shoulder, or you can go through his note. His email is spacenetreport@gmail.com. But if any of the other reasons you want to contact me, the best email address is mailbag@acs.com. Again, mailbag@, my call sign is AlphaCharlie2GulfSierra.com. Maintain an interesting link page. It's available 24/7. It has articles of interest, YouTubes of interest, all kinds of fun stuff. There's some pictures that Paul will probably cite during the SpaceNet report later tonight. And you can reach my link page by typing into your browser URL, roy.ac2guest.com. Again, that's Roy, my first name, .ac2guest, my call sign, .com. We have a chat room available. You can go to Limar's website, get the link there, or you can just type into your browser chat.ac2gs.com, and that'll bring you to our chat room. I always like to tell people that if you have people that can't quite make it in through the radio link or IRLP or Echo link, I have an audio stream available. So if you have just a computer connection of some kind, if you type into your browser technet.ac2gs.com, that'll give you an audio stream so you can listen to W2VL as much as you want all week long. I keep it live as much as I can. And I want to remind people that Mike, KC2NJI, has a wonderful site, a website called amateurradio.tv. He's had over 1 billion visitors, and he maintains an archive of technical nets, Limar technical nets, going as far back as September of 2006. So there's a lot of wisdom there. So please try it out. Let me drop for a second, and I'll tell you my plans for tonight. Okay. As per usual, I will ask for any questions of a technical nature. I will take first name and call sign, and I will try to address the question or comment in the order that people check in for that purpose. If there is free time, I will open the questions up to general science and even medicine, as long as it's not specific to anyone. We do not treat nor diagnose over the radio. But if you want to discuss some interesting aspects of science, I'm game if you are. At that point, if we still have more time, I have some science talk articles that we could discuss if that's of interest to some people. That should take us approximately to 10:15, in which it will be time for Paul, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report, which will take us to about 11 o'clock p.m., in which I will return, tie a little bow on it, wish you well, and call it a week. So that's the plan. If the repeater, the radio, and all the bits of you that let me talk to you are willing and able to work tonight. So with that in mind, if anyone has any questions or topics for tonight, please give me your first name and your call sign.
KD2 UDU Wayne supporting the net.
You Wayne. Anyone? out there. Another quiet night. So please, give me your first name and your call sign if you have any questions or comments for tonight.
KD2VYY, supporting the net. Good evening.
Okay, very good, Raymond. Thanks for supporting the net. Anyone out there with a question or a topic for tonight that we can kind of mull around and discuss and learn something from? Okay, Wes, you want to go a little bit later because maybe it's more of a science than an amateur radio tech type of a topic? I didn't quite make that out.
Yeah, I'm reviewing the computer right now, the updates and whatsoever, so yeah, I can go later. The topic is hydrogen car, but it's hydrogen electric car. It's a lot that is changing right now, so I'm going to be ready a little bit later.
Okay, we'll pencil you in for later. Once again, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limar Technical Desk. If anyone has any questions or topics they would like to discuss tonight, please hit that push to talk button and give me your first name and your call sign. Oh, well, I guess I'm just having one of those weeks here. Let me share with you a little story of my experiences recently in trying to get something to work and finally getting it to work. And hopefully I won't time out the repeater and or bore anyone. I'm a member of two radio clubs in addition to Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club. I'm a member of the local Kings County Radio Club. And we have a repeater, and we have some nets, and unfortunately one person contacted me and was having problems reading the repeater and wanted to know if there was some method through her computer that she could do that. Now, you people at Limark can easily tell people to get on Echolink. There are people on Echolink right now. But Kings County didn't have Echolink. So I decided that, what the hell, Echolink doesn't actually cost anything, theoretically, so let me see if I can do Echolink. I happen to have a signal link from Tigertronic that's capable of turning audio from my FDM-400 into a digital ones and zeros, and I figured I could use it for Echolink. Let me drop for a sec. So, thankfully, they updated. For about 6-7 years, as far as I'm aware, they didn't update it, but they got into this habit that night that they updated. The latest version is something like 2.3. 2.3 has some nice additional functionality built into it. It includes an extra input and output, so that is a systems operator at the repeater site can hook up a microphone and transmit through that link of the software. So you hook up the inputs and the outputs from Echolink to my Tigertronic signal link. I hook up my microphone to the input of 2.3, and I gave it a go. And the first thing that I noticed was, for some strange reason, there was a hum going on in the audio. So at first I thought, gee, could it be a 6-week cycle hum? Fortunately, I'm able to actually run a frequency scan on it. No, it was about 72 hertz, which was confusing. So at first I notched out the filters on my digital software, and that got rid of it, but it still annoyed me. So I looked further into the documentation, and one of the features for the latest, greatest Echolink is that it introduces what it calls sub-audible tone. Now, a sub-audible tone on a repeater is not the same as a sub-audible tone in your ear. because I can hear 72 hertz, and I'm sure you guys can too. It's just that when it runs through a lot of circuits involved in repeaters, they drop out the lower frequency range for the sake of people being annoyed by the PL cell. So I disabled that feature, and that went away, so I solved one problem. Let me drop again. I noticed that I had another problem. Whenever the radio was transmitting, there was this hash signal coming from the radio received output of the signal link back into Echo Link, and everyone was disturbed by this harsh noise background. That was a little confusing. I at first thought that it might be some RF getting into something, and I tried ferrite feed beyond belief without any kind of resolution. I then finally realized that what was happening was that the way that the signal link handles the audio signal from my Yaesu FTM400, it takes it from a data port. Now, the data port, for whatever reason, does not have a squelch during transmit. So any kind of random noise that's in the receiver circuit when I'm transmitting on the radio gets sent straight to Echo Link to the ears of everyone listening. I pondered that little problem, and then I decided that the get around was not to take the audio output of the radio through the data port. You can do that by opening up the chassis, and there's a bunch of little jumpers. You can disconnect the audio output going into the sound card mechanism. You still have to supply another audio signal, and thankfully the FTM400 had a speaker output. I plugged the speaker output into the digital link external signal input, and it worked. So took about a week to figure out all the ins and outs and otherwise, but our Echo Link is apparently fully functional. Unfortunately, the repeater kind of crashed over the weekend, so it's down for the time being, but when it comes back up, we'll have an Echo Link for it. So that's my little story of trying to figure out something. You know, if you ever have Echo Link, you should take a look under the hood. It's a very interesting piece of software. Anyway, this is AC2GS. Any comments out there?
Kilo Delta 2, Romeo Echo Kilo, with the question whenever you're ready, regarding a different topic.
Okay, very good. I'm open to another topic. Can you give me your first name?
Of course, it's Brian, a member of Limewalk. How are you this evening? I hope well.
Yes, Brian, I am very well, thank you. What would be your question for tonight?
I attended a watch show this weekend, and Casio model watches the atomic clock coming out of, I believe it's Colorado, and they were telling me that, I don't believe they were truly in the know, that the atomic clock signal that I believe it's, I don't know what the frequency is or much about it or how it's read to the watch, etc., that it's going to be discontinued. Just wondering how that worked and if you felt it was going to be.
We talked about that, I think, a year or so ago. It was unclear to me whether this was kind of legitimate or just a budgetary fight that everyone was having. Because apparently the budget isn't enough to maintain it, or the interest isn't enough to maintain it. So I think it's a bargaining chip, although it scared a lot of other people. So I'm thinking that it's not something that's going to go away anytime too soon. It's just, in my opinion, it's just a bit of saber rattling at this point.
Thank you. I appreciate that.
VDH with a comment.
VDH.
Yeah, I just wanted to mention, that is that 60 kilohertz, 60 kilohertz. And the way it transmits data, it's essentially very, very slow amplitude shifting. It's about a bit rate of about maybe 1 or 2 bits per second. Very slow because it's at that low frequency, you can't have high data rates. Again, that's 60 kilohertz.
We talked about that before, especially very low frequency transmissions and how submarines used to use frequencies in that range. And the problem with it is that the symbol rates are so slow that they could only send very small amounts of actual information for a given time. I think nowadays submarines very often will just launch some little buoy and bounce off a satellite and have a full bandwidth of signals. With time regulations, thankfully you don't need that much information. You just need a small amount that it's capable of. But I don't know, have you read anything recently? The last time that I heard, it sounded to me like saber rattling, that they wanted more money for the budget, and if they didn't get it, they might shut down WWZ. You know, no one wants that. You know, everyone has an atomic clock someplace in their house, so, they'll be rather worthless without it.
Yeah, I think there's a significant involvement with a commitment to existing clocks that use that 60 kilohertz signal for timekeeping. That I don't think it's going to be shut down. There's too much of an economic commitment to it.
I agree as well. I mean, it's sort of a shame when agencies have this measuring their thoughts at each other and playing chicken with each other, because the general public ends up getting confused and a little bit more demoralized. Do you really trust what you read in the paper and such? So, I don't know whether that served any purpose for them doing that. But, as far as I know, WWB is safe and going to continue for the foreseeable future. So everyone, don't worry about that. There's a lot of other things to worry about, but don't bother wasting your time worrying about that.
As a matter of fact, I think there were some upgrades that were made to WWBB. That's the very low frequency one. I think there were some upgrades made. I think they did something, introduced a certain amount of phase shift keying. I'm not sure on that. But I know there was an upgrade done within the last 2 or 3 years or so.
That's very good. I could believe that easily. Engineers like to tweak things and adjust things. Bureaucrats like to threaten things. So I think the engineers will keep things rolling with the atomic clock. And, I have the time standard. I have one of those synchronized atomic clocks in my kitchen. They work very nicely. We've talked about this before. You need a decent signal, unfortunately. There are low-sensitivity receiver versions of this atomic clock where, unfortunately, you have to put them close to a window in order for them to sync. The one that I got a few years ago was sensitive enough that I leave it in the middle of my Faraday cage of a house. We have plastering with chicken wire, so it acts as a reasonably good Faraday cage if you need one. But despite that, it synchronizes most nights. So just make sure you get a decent quality atomic clock if you're into such things, or that you're willing to place it by the window every so often to sync it. Okay, thanks, Brian, for the question and the participation. Anyone else out there with any questions of science or even medicine, as long as you don't want a diagnosis or treatment plan. We're opening it up early for tonight.
WA2VDH with an MRI question.
Okay, John.
Yeah, my question is about the magnet in the MRI machine. I understand that's a superconducting magnet, and once it's established, they get liquid helium, and it's on forever, as I understand. They do have a quench mechanism where when they want to shut it down. I wonder if you could describe that a little bit.
Well, John, you kind of described it as best that I could. I've never really looked into the complete design. Magnetic resonance imaging is a very interesting technology. It actually used to be used by chemists long before medicine, and it was given a different name. It was called nuclear magnetic resonance. Because people get frightened when they hear of nuclear, they change to magnetic resonance imaging. Well, what it amounts to is you lie a very strong magnetic field, and then you sweep RF across it with a sensor, and at a certain resonance of the nucleus rotating, it will cause a slight absorption in the RF. And by scanning, detecting the RF dips and so, you can straight that into a three-dimensional image and see all kinds of interesting things. Most magnetic resonance imaging is based on hydrogen bonding, so it really is sensitive to water distribution in organ systems. As John mentioned, you need a very powerful magnet, so they use a superconducting magnet to get that high an intensity of Teslas. And once you do it, you're kind of stuck with it, because if you break it, it quenches with a lot of back current. And so you need a special device built into the system for the occasional maintenance when you power it down to quench it. So it's basically just a very, very sturdy shorting device that will tolerate, probably slow down the amount of current, but tolerate the enormous amount of amperes that are produced by the collapse of that strong magnetic field.
Once the field collapses, how do they restart it that they can't have it superconducting as you try to restart it because it ejects the field? How do they restart it?
Again, unfortunately, never designed one, never really looked into the design of one. If you introduce a lower current into the electromagnet when it hasn't reached superconducting temperatures, you can kind of ease it back into the state of superconducting without having any kind of problems with a back current from the change of state. So, again, this is a guesstimate on my part. But I would assume that they run it at low current initially and bring the temperatures closer and closer to superconducting as they raise the current flow.
Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah, it would have to be a very gradual process. I just had one, as a matter of fact, so I was talking to one of the techs about it, and I was asking about all the noises that it makes, and he said that's due to the fact that they have to steer the high point of the magnetic field with the secondary exciter coils, and that's done at usually near audio rates. So as they pulse current through there, those coils vibrate, and that's what makes all the rackets and noise. Sometimes it almost sounds musical. That's what generates all those strange noises. So anyway, it's a very interesting thing. Very interesting.
Yes, they are. It almost, the first few times I went into one of those rooms, it reminded me more of a machine shop, because it sounded like metal banging on metal. But yeah, that's the reason for that interesting tendency of making that weird noise. Shutting down MRI machines and quenching them is probably a large pain in the backside, because as far as I'm aware, they do it as infrequently as they could possibly get away with. Another interesting aspect that we covered years ago on the technical mess was that there is a degree of helium leak found that their Apple iPhones were malfunctioning because a MEM device that's used in some cell phone is malfunctions, and the iPhone fails for about a week or so before the fusion allows it to dissipate.
Yeah, and they have to vent it outside, otherwise they get everybody starts talking with that helium voice, sounding like Kermit the Frog.
It reminds me of the odd person doing single sideband off frequency.
GXM.
West2N.
Yes, Rich and Paul recognized. Rich first.
AC2GS, this is WB2GXM. I thought that somehow I've heard that it was slightly poisonous or.
Yeah, it's wrong. Helium is one of the noble gases. It almost never reacts with anything, so it is a completely inert substance. Obviously, if you breathe helium instead of oxygen, that's not good. But it's not from the helium per se. A lot of people regularly will breathe in party balloons filled with helium without any side effects. So, I'm not quite sure what that kind of idea came from. But as far as I'm aware, helium is one of the safest things that I can think of these days.
WB2AW3?
Yes, Cap.
From what I recall, divers who are down at great depths for prolonged periods of time breathe heliox, which is essentially a helium and oxygen mixture. Basically, they use the helium to prevent the bends, to prevent the nitrogen in regular air from causing damage to the blood vessels.
Yeah, that's right, Ken. Extreme low diving benefits from a helium-oxygen mixture. Again, helium's a great thing to play with. It does all kinds of fun stuff. It runs cryogenic freezers. Wesley can tell you stories about his. And it's great for party balloons. The trouble is that we have an incredibly limited supply of helium. It is a slowly renewing material. Slowly in that it is produced solely by the decay of radioactive material in the Earth's core. So it's not like we're going to find a heck of a lot more helium all of a sudden or make it ourselves. Some people are even discussing going to the moon to mine an isotope of helium that's expensive enough to pay for the cost of propulsion and such. But helium is very useful, very safe, as long as you're not an iPhone. But as far as biological systems are concerned, it is the least reactive element in the periodic table. There is compounds that are made of helium, but they are really strange and only exist under very unique pressures and temperatures.
BDH with a comment?
Yes. John.
So what is it that about the vocal cords that causes that helium voice when helium, what does it do, tighten?
It's purely the density of the gas. As you lower the density of the gas that your vocal cords vibrate, they will shift frequency up. There was also a story I told years ago of, I forget what it was called, some tetrafluoride that's relatively inert, but it's a very dense gas. And if you breathe that in, you become a baritone. So it's purely the density of the gas that affects the frequency of the vibrating vocal cords.
Oh, it has nothing to do with it being absorbed onto the surface of the cords or anything like that?
No, it has nothing to do with that. It is simply the local density of, you know, how quickly you can move the air. Helium can be moved with less energy much faster, so all of a sudden your cords are vibrating higher, and as you increase the density of the gas that your vocal cords are vibrating on, they get lower and lower and lower. But if nothing is absorbed, it's all just basic acoustics.
I see. Okay, thanks.
Thanks. Welcome, John. Paul, you wanted to say something. WS2M, I think that you raised your voice here. Did you want to say something?
Okay. I didn't think I was making it. Okay, very good. Yeah, I got involved with a partial install of two of these MRIs that came in. They were manufactured and they were shipped with helium, and the helium was actually being off gas as it went from wherever it was manufactured to the hospital itself. And I mean, that thing, it was like it was alive sitting on this truck, like a breathing machine, you know, because they didn't have it, you know, they want to be able to bring it into the building, and at that point it's not being refrigerated. They had it refrigerated on the truck with equipment, but then by the time it gets into the building, you've got time before they made, and they have a cascade refrigeration system to bring those coils down to those ridiculous temperatures. In other words, you'll have one refrigeration system, you'll have an evaporator system that's being cooled by a condenser system, and so on. Maybe, it's like three different cycles, different refrigerants until they reach the low numbers on the evaporator inside that machine. So, I mean, I don't know what they do nowadays. This was back in the 90s. I would imagine they've progressed a little bit where they don't have to go through this. It was like time. We're only allowed a certain amount of time to from what it...
It's tough to handle. I think to this at this time too, it's still problematic. There are refrigeration devices that are kind of more efficient at different temperature ranges. So that's most likely the reason for the multiple levels of refrigeration. So that there are some refrigerants that if you give them too high a temperature, they just stop working entirely. So you have to use a cruder device to get it down to a certain number, and then plug in a little bit more finesse, little sensitive device, and then finally use the most sophisticated technology that would break under the higher temperatures. So I think in many ways the same thing is going on. Yeah, it's sort of fascinating. We play a lot with helium. We use a lot of it. I'm kind of concerned about the future of it, because every so often I will read an article where they're saying, they get them in mine deposits where there are closed off areas because they are caused by the decay of radioactive material, and little by little the gas kind of slowly creeps around and through the rock and collects in these sealed off cavities of the earth. We're going to have problems if we can't find some other source for helium, but I don't know exactly what source other than going into space we could find.
Yeah, I know. Well, they go through a lot of helium in the space program. A lot of the propellants are pressurized by helium when they're in space. They're able to. It's easy to keep the fluids being pushed in the right direction. You don't want it just sloshing around in a tank. You would wind up with cavitating in the turbo pumps. So you tremendous amount of helium. So they're getting it from somewhere, I guess. It's all coming out of nuclear decay. All this helium that they're using.
Yeah, natural helium that was on the planet slowly diffuses out the atmosphere and goes into space. So all of this is for the most part nuclear decay. They get it in when they oil rigs, you know, when they're getting methane gas and such. A lot of times they're able to spin down some helium from that. There are large cavities and caves. So far so good, but we don't have a heck of a lot of it, and you know, it's kind of easy to lose. Once it escapes into the air, it's not like other gases like oxygen and nitrogen. You just put pressure on it, liquefy it, put it in a tank, and reuse it repeatedly. This stuff will just kind of slowly float it out of space. Now, to me, the thing that's kind of remarkable in a way is that helium is the second most abundant substance in the universe. The only thing that there's more of in our universe is hydrogen. So it only goes to show that location, location, location. We don't have a lot of helium, but outer space has loads of it.
Okay, yeah, sure. Look at the sun. It's nothing but one big helium fusion reactor. Wow. Converting all that hydrogen to helium. Very good. I'll let you continue. Back to you, Roy. WS2N.
Thank you, Paul. Yeah, it's kind of remarkable. After the Big Bang, about 95% of particles out there were hydrogen atoms, and 5% were helium. And as suns burn up in nuclear fusion, hydrogen, they give off as out products helium, both helium-3 and helium-4. So the sun has a good supply of helium, but you know, even outer space, the problem is it's just not very dense. It's difficult to get a big collection of helium. So eventually, hopefully, someone will figure that one out as well. But helium is taken for granted by too many people. There's a lot of manufacturing, industrial stuff, scientific stuff that requires helium, not just party balloons. So I hope they find another source for it somewhere, somehow. Anyway, this is AC2GS, and this is the Limark Technical Net, so if you have a question or a topic for discussion, please hit that push-to-talk button and give me your first name and your call sign.
WB2GX.
Yes, Rich.
AC2GS, this is WB2GXM. Hello again, Roy. I do have a question. I have a 51-year-old or so coaxial cable. It's running from my basement to my attic through the wall. And I'm just wondering what the chances are that it's still good and how I may test it.
I think the best way of testing coaxial cable, and I'm interested to hear other people's opinions, is with a vector network analyzer that can now be had for about $60. What I have done in the past is I hook it up. Most modern-day vector network analyzers have a function called time-domain reflectometry. What that effectively does is it kind of sends an RF sonar ping down your transmission line and then looks for any discontinuities in impedance. So to me, that's the best way. Some people who don't have too much equipment use a volt ohm meter just to see if they have a DC continuity. That's really not sufficient in my mind, because coaxial cables are not DC devices. They're RF devices. So my best suggestion would be either get yourself a nice little, and I hate to sound like I'm old at this thing, nano VNA, or something that works similarly, or borrow it from a friend, and do a sweep with a T-DAR. See what kind of impedance you have for the total length of the coax cable.
We have nano VNA. I haven't used it yet, but now I have a use for it.
Yes, indeed. It's a nice little bit of kit, as the British would say. I have run PCRs for all kinds of interesting and silly reasons. Sometimes I have a long length of cable, and I'm not willing to take a tape measure and extend it out across my house and measure it. So I just hook it up to a TDR. As long as you know its velocity factor, it'll tell you exactly the length of your coax cable. I've also experimented with connectors and jumpers, and you can actually see a little glitch as it passes through a UHF, a PL259, what have you, a connector. It just doesn't make any fundamental difference for the most part. But you can actually pick it up on a decent TDR. So it's a very nice additional feature. I don't hear too many talking about it. Most people who have a VNA are kind of more focused on, gee, how is my antenna working than how is my transmission line working. But it's a very good tool for that. So give it a try, and you may discover something.
Do you think that a 51-year-old coax that's not exposed to the weather may still be good?
Well, you got a chance. You know, manufacturing of stuff back in the good old days tended to be a wee bit more sturdy than I think they are these days. Still working under spec. Consider yourself a very lucky person, but I wouldn't call it an impossibility as long as it's inside the house. Outside the house, lots of rock.
Thank you, Roy. WB2GX, I'm clear.
Taxi number.
Wesley, what do you got for us?
Little news, little explanation. So we have electric cars. Some of us noticed that we have almost in every corner Tesla. It's a Model 3. So it's inexpensive, $31,000, $32,000, if I remember correctly. And they have a Model M, about $50,000. Did I demate it myself into a share? And we thought, okay, this is top of the mountains. We are going green. And everything is hunky-dory, like a dick set. However, we'll have a much progress of the hydrogen car. So, many of people not skilled in that art would say, well, we have a combustion engine, but you use the gas. Like in some application, some gas was used instead of gasoline. But, actually, we have electric car that has a fuel cell. And that fuel cell operates on hydrogen. But actually, hydrogen is taken from water. So at home, you could have a battery or the DC power supply, and you could split water to H2O. But actually, it's HHO. They call it HHO. But the process of electrolysis is actually to get the hydrogen too, and then that hydrogen is stored in the tank and is delivered to the car. And here is very interesting thing. We have a special cell that is called PEM. Before I go to that, I would like to say that there's a lot of movement. Zero emission fuel cells offered by capacity trucks. So we have in America, already production of Northern American hydrogen fuel electric, cell electric hybrid truck. Now, hydrogen is many times, not few percent, it's many times more effective or energetic per volume than gasoline. The capacity truck is a subsidiary of Air EV Group, and they are on New York Stock Exchange. You can find them there. They are located in the port of Long Beach, California. But then Toyota has very inexpensive $15,000 car And I sent you the picture of it along with all the links, so you can put it on your website. And that's a Toyota Mirai, M-I-R-A-E. The price that I got, 15,000 euro, was that in Ukraine, I saw today, there are two guys who have those $15,000 cars. One of them is Minister of Water Resources of Ukrainian government. And the other one is just a regular guy. So they have two of them, but in Germany they have plenty of them, and they have a gas station to fuel them. The stunning for me was to hear that from 145 euro charge of hydrogen, the car was able to make 1,350 kilometers, which comes to about 1,000 miles. Okay, so how that works, how that fuel works. We have a short video that you can play on the website. The PEM is polymer electrolyte membrane. Fuel cells it is used in automobiles and called proton exchange membrane. Fuel cells use hydrogen fuel and oxygen from air to produce electricity. The diaphragm. There is a small animation also for that. So at first we have a hydrogen fuel that is channeled through the field flow plate to the anode on one side of the fuel cell, while oxygen from the air is channeled to the cathode on the other side of the fuel cell. At the anode, the platinum catalyst causes the hydrogen to split into the positive hydrogen ions, which is protons, and the negatively charged electrons. The polymer electrode membrane, PEM, allows only the positively charged ions to pass through it to the cathode. The negatively charged electrons must travel along an electrical circuit to the cathode, creating an electric current. So the movement makes the current. At the cathode, the electron and positively charged hydrogen ions combine with the oxygen from water, which flows out of the cell. So we have a leaky car. So actually we drive and we have a leaky car.
Wesley?
Go ahead.
The email you sent me, it says the Toyota Mirai has been shrunken into a hydrogen-fueled RC car. What does the RC stand for? The only RC that I'm aware of is remote control, which makes little sense here.
I cannot answer that question because I got to the subject very shortly before the TechNet. I was thinking about talking about other subjects that I have sent you emails about it, and I decided that this is kind of hot because we thought the electric car might save our money, and it looks like that a 1,000 miles per 43, even 47 euro. What is it, $56, $60, is much more than Tesla is offering us for each single charge. And to achieve.
Okay, but you also unfortunately have to factor in that there's no readily available way of distributing hydrogen safely across the world to feed these fuel-based electronic cars. So you have to factor the infrastructure costs and overhead into all of these equations for it to really legitimately make sense.
Here's the solution. The news from yesterday, Ukraine is talking to Toyota, or is already signing agreement with Toyota. They have an existing pipeline for the gas that is going to Europe. And that was the Northern Stream 2 that is going at the bottom of the Baltic Sea, was that one that was blocked by President Trump. Was allowed to be finished by our current president. Ukraine is volunteering to have the hydrogen production, and because Russia is making sanction on sending the gas, natural gas, through that pipeline, they are willing to use that pipeline to deliver to Europe, especially to Germany, the hydrogen through that pipeline, and that makes it very much inexpensive. We got to look at it from different perspective.
Okay, D2RY.
If we say that we have all of the electronics right now from China, it is because China has inexpensive labor. So the same story is in Ukraine, having a very inexpensive labor. But Ukraine is much more advanced in the human capital than China was many years ago. So right now we're talking about a convenient location, and we're talking about the ability to have a huge amount of that gas to be delivered to Europe. Now, how is it with United States? I have no idea. But I know that plenty of those cars are already in Germany, and Toyota is quite a big company to make a push and create a much competition with Tesla, that Tesla is only electric. And to exist.
KD2FIU.
Yes, George recognized, but David recognized also. David had a transmission, so we'll get first to David and then to George. I just want to put my little two cents. Natural gas is mostly methane. It's not hydrogen. They might repurpose the conduit to transfer hydrogen, and then there's some they have to use to change to hydrogen gas. But that's only the bringing it to a central location at best. What you need for cars like that, you needed to have charging stations for Teslas all over the country. You need to have local places that will charge up your hydrogen cells in order to be operational. You know, if you buy a car that only has one hydrogen cell plates that you can charge it up with hydrogen for every 150 or 200 miles, then no one's going to buy that, because you basically have to drive from charger to charger. So that's my little two cents worth. But first, let me ask David what he wanted to say, and then we'll get to you, George.
QSL, good evening, everybody. Wesley, I have a question for you. You know, everybody is talking about climate change and the environment. They're talking about creating clean renewable energy sources. My question is, I know it requires a lot of emitting of carbon to actually manufacture any car, whether it's petroleum, or if it's electric, or if it's hydrogen. And the other question I have is, how is the hydrogen made? Is there combustion involved? And is it good for the environment? Go ahead.
Okay, two answers. First, it's a totally clean energy. It's water to water. So water is split, we get hydrogen from the water, and then at the end of the process we have water. So the car is actually leaking. When it's driving, it's actually leaking. So you might, with the number of cars driving, you might have a wet road. The second thing is, it's no combustion at all. It is membrane. I have at home a number of devices that makes nitrogen. And nitrogen is used through the membrane. There is no combustion. It's a cold process. It's a filter. That's all. Now, in here, we have a similar to that filter membrane, which is called PEM. Now, the second answer to Roy. There is an existing pipeline. That pipeline would be converted from Ukraine. That was used to transport natural gas from Russia through Ukraine to Europe. But because of annexation of Crimea, there is a turbulence, a problem between Russia and Ukraine, and Russia wants to actually punish Ukraine by omitting Ukraine in that. So Ukraine came to the solution that they could actually produce the gas, the hydrogen, and sent through that existing pipe. Now, as far as the gas stations for the hydrogen, there are plenty of them. In almost every gas station, you have a natural gas for the gasoline engines. So the gasoline engines could utilize a gasoline or the natural gas. The only what is needed is to exchange the tank for the one that is suitable for hydrogen and to exchange.
This way.
Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a whole bunch of points. Number one, splitting water into oxygen and hydrogen, otherwise known as electrolysis, you're utilizing the energy potential of bonds. A hydrogen bonded to an oxygen has a lower potential energy than hydrogen not bonded to oxygen. By applying power in the way of an electric current, you separate the hydrogen from the oxygen. You get oxygen gas, you get hydrogen gas. You then have to answer the question of where did the electricity for the electrolysis come from? Did it come from a nuclear reactor, or did it come from a coal-burning electricity generator? So it's not as simple as we break the water apart and then we put it back together and it's all fine. You have to do something to break it apart. And in a way, hydrogen and oxygen giving off energy is combustion. It could be combustion in very slow, controlled scale, but it's a reduction oxidation reaction, and that's what generates the energy. When you take oxygen and hydrogen gas and put it together with a little spark, it pops and gives you water, but it pops. So the pop is the energy of the change in the potential energy of the bond. So that's that point. I don't know of any large-scale natural gas facilities in gas stations. They'll fill up a tank or something, but they'll fill up a car, and in what way will they fill up a car? Hydrogen gas is a little different than methane. I don't think that the two equate very simply. I don't think you could just roll out one tank, roll out another, and call it a day. But still, I think I'd like to hear what George has to say, and then you can come back and answer me, please.
Okay. George.
George, are you out there? You wanted to say something, please. Perhaps he stepped away. Anyway, David, do you want to reply to Wesley, and then he'll reply to both of us?
I have really nothing else to say, and you yourself, Roy, made it more clear that the process of making the hydrogen requires some kind of either chemical reaction or some kind of combustion, which requires power from a source
It could be petroleum or coal or nuclear. And the other thing I think about for the environment, you know, is the use of pipelines. You know, you want to get rid of the pipelines to make the environment better. So I was just thinking about that, you know, as soon as I said, well,